Accession number 7260, reel 3.
Mr. Davison, Langley, reel 3.
We came back into the battalion, coming in round from the north side, wheeling in round, I think, through Black Hill. And as we came in there, there was a raid going in. We saw the Italian planes coming in onto the headquarters position on Castle Hill, and we just stayed where we were until the raid was over. At Black Hill reported us to the battalion. We reported to them, and they reported us to the battalion. They had a radio to get on, and they just passed us through then, and we went back into headquarters.
I think near here there was a Castle Hill as well, wasn't there?
Well, Castle Hill was there. There were two hills together, Castle Hill and the other one. I think I've got it on the map here. So we went back into Castle King and King Hill, which are two features, and that was battalion headquarters.
Was there actually a castle on the top of Castle Hill?
No, there was no castle. There was nothing at all. It was just given that name because it had a vague resemblance to a castle, looking at it from the east.
I think that you said that soon afterwards that an Italian reconnaissance bomber came over.
Well, after we got back in there, we stayed the night. And the following evening, we were sent back some miles down the road to Berbera to rest after the trek back from Hargeisa. And we got into a sort of a trackless place off the road. There was no name to it, there was no nothing, it was just sand, and we went in there. And we were there for the night, and in the early morning, there was a heavy, an Italian Savoia bomber came over. He was flying very low, so low that the whole ground was vibrating from the sound of the engines. And we were just hoping he didn't see us, but he didn't do anything about it. Now, shortly after that, and this happened about, 7 o'clock in the morning, something like that. Shortly after that, maybe an hour later, we got an urgent message that the whole unit had to go back to battalion because we had to do an attack on the left flank. They'd lost some ground there and had to be try and recover it. So they sent some trucks down for us. We got on and we went back there.
What form was this counterattack supposed to take?
Well, it was two platoons went out. It was my platoon and another one. Two infantry platoons from D Company. And we simply had this high ground. We had to take it. We had no artillery or anything like that for us. It was simply a straightforward infantry attack with bayonet.
How did the attack go?
Well, in fact, the attack was aborted. But before it was aborted, I had already led off, and my batman had followed me. We'd been occupying a dry riverbed, a dry nullah, and I'd spread the troops, both platoons, up and down that. And at the time to go, I passed the word long go, and I went out with my and my batman followed immediately behind me. And he'd only gone a couple of yards when he was hit, and he went down. I kept on, but I noticed that nobody else was coming. And I must have done, I suppose, a couple of hundred yards. A heavy fire, the sand was sort of spurting all round, but nothing hit me. But then I went down behind a little bit of a thorn bush because I saw there was no attack was going to go in. And I had to stay there until dark before I could get back to where our positions were.
How long were you behind the thorn bush?
I would say it must have been about 2 hours. It was late in the day. We'd moved up during the day from the rear position where we'd been resting. And then we'd been briefed on what we had to do, and then we'd been moved out over to the left flank, and it all took quite a lot of time. So it was mid-afternoon, a bit later, when actually we went forward to go for the positions. So I was left out there on my own. When it got dark, I made a break and got back. And then I discovered that an officer had come through from battalion and the attack had been aborted, been called off. And this is why none of the rest of the men followed. otherwise it wouldn't actually would have done so.
How was it that the order hadn't got to you?
It was being passed by word of mouth down the line. We were all lined up inside this dry riverbed up against the forward bank, as if it had been in a trench, for example. It was being passed down from man to man. It just happened that I went just before it reached me.
I think you said that the position of this abortive counterattack was back from Observation Hill.
Yes. It would be back there with the ground we were looking for was on the left of Observation Hill. It was interfering with Observation Hill, a little bit to the left and to the rear of them. Had been held by other troops and they'd lost it. But our position, of course, was that we had to try and take this, and it was a very tough position. It was not a hill like the rest of the positions around there were. It was more like an escarpment, and it was quite a steep embankment up to the top. And it was a couple of hundred feet high, it wasn't a small thing. So it wouldn't have been very pleasant taking it.
What happened next?
When I got back, we were told to pull back from the position in the dry riverbed and to dig in for the night. And we pulled back. There was a ridge behind us, not very high, but it was just rising ground. And we went back behind the crest of that, and we spent the whole night digging, but we were only using pangas, which was the weapon carried by the Askari. We had no picks or shovel. And because it was rock underneath, we just got virtually nowhere. You know, a few inches was all you got. You couldn't get anywhere. At first light, an attack came in, and because of the position we were in back from the crest, we couldn't see the first wave of the attackers until it came up over the top when they were virtually on top of us. At that time, a messenger had come through from battalion to the officer who'd taken over, and we were told to pull back and get out.
I think you said before that this was quite a confused action.
A very confused action, yes.
In what sense?
Well, first, when he went out, I had the two platoons. When I was isolated out in front after I'd gone into the attack and left on my own, by the time I got back, the officer who'd brought the instruction that the attack was aborted, he had taken over the two platoons, which he naturally would do, being commissioned officer. He pulled back behind this ridge. And the Italian neo-colonial infantry came in, and they seemed very vague about what they were doing themselves. They were almost intermingled with us. We were trying to get back to retreat in order and sort of control our retreat and keep everybody under control and get them back. And they didn't seem to be pressing an attack very much. They were there and sort of threatening, but they weren't sort of doing a lot. One threw a money box grenade at one of the men close to me. He put his hand up to stop it. And the money box, the Italian money box grenade, is an impact grenade. It's very light. It doesn't do an awful lot of damage, but there's a lot of explosive in it. And it blew his three fingers off his hand, his little finger the next two. And this Scari, using his remaining one finger, the first finger and his thumb, he shot the Italian quite close to him. And it was as close as that, and as intermingled as that. You were in the position where you weren't fighting a rearguard action, and you didn't know exactly what you were doing. You had to get your men back. You had to get back to a certain position, because those were the orders. The enemy were interfering, yet they weren't interfering sufficiently to justify sort of a turnaround and a stand or a counterattack or anything like that. They were so there like a nuisance value.
Why were they called money box grenades?
They were painted a bright red, like a sort of pillar box red. And they were about the size of a goose egg, if you can imagine that. But oval in shape, fitted nicely into the hand. But I think it's largely because of their shape and the red colour they call them money box.
What happened next?
Well, we broke off. They broke off, they left, they seemed to be happy to see us go, they didn't seem to want to interfere any further, and we got back into battalion. And there we went into the main attacks, then started to come in almost immediately. They started that night. We had heavy bombardment. And from then on until the time we evacuated Tuggeranong, it was sort of a day and night siege.
Were you surprised at the decision to evacuate British Somaliland?
Yes, we were surprised at the decision to evacuate. We thought, or we hoped, that we'd get reinforcements. I mean, we held out not an awful long time, but considering the numbers against us and the material against us, we held out fairly well. We thought, well, it wouldn't be too difficult to drive the Italians back. A few guns and that was it, but we got nothing. So it was a surprise, yes.
But the Italians presumably would have had many advantages.
In what way?
Over you.
Oh, they had. They had armour, for one thing. They had tanks. They had armoured cars as well. They had any amount of artillery. They had motorised artillery. They had motorised AK-AK. And, of course, they got their air force. And their artillery. Well, their artillery was pounding us all the time.
Can you describe the withdrawal from the area where you were being besieged?
The word came down, it came to me as a platoon sergeant from the company commander that we were to pull out, and I was to get the platoon ready to pull out that night, take all our equipment, anything else would be left. Well, there wasn't very much of anything else anyway. We just took our equipment, our rifles, ammunition, and that was that. And they said we'd move out late that night and we were going to try and go through the enemy lines. We were warned that it might be a question of fighting and we might have to fight our way through. Our objective was to get back to Berbera.
Did you get through their lines all right?
We got through their lines without any bother at all. There wasn't any contact whatsoever.
Why do you think that was?
I just can't imagine it. It just seemed as though the Italians seemed to pack up at night and decide to go back to camp or something. The same as the situation outside Hargeisa when we went through the tanks. I could not imagine it happening anywhere else in any other army, say with the Germans or the Japanese or anything like that. We had a string of tanks down the road in enemy territories and no sentries, no nothing, that anybody could just walk through. Anyway, that's the way it was. It was the same there. They'd got us surrounded, and yet whether they'd pulled back for the night and gone to the bivouac, I don't know. But we made no contact at all.
Was there any Italian pressure on you as you were withdrawing to Berbera?
No. We retired down the road a few miles and went through the Black Watch. 2nd Italian Black Watch were there, and they covered us and let us through, and we went into a sort of a rest position. We're still a long way from Berbera. The Italians didn't seem to press on at all. It seemed to be right along, right through the engagement. When they first attacked us, they never seemed to press home an advantage. They seemed to be content to sort of harass and that. They put in quite a lot of heavy attacks, but they weren't really good. You know, they weren't intelligently applied. They used to mass their men, they used to come in and they used to take heavy casualties and they used to back up and retreat. And I can't imagine Germans doing that.
Did they make good use of ground?
No. No, they seemed to come out of the open. Just walk across it.
Was there any reaction from the Somali population at the evacuation from British Somaliland?
From the Somali population itself, not as far as I know, but then I had virtually no contact with them. There was very few of them. Berbera was such a small place, it was, we'd hardly justify the term of village, you know, with a few mud hovels and things like that and little shops. And I think there were as many Arabs as Somalis in there, for what there was, but there's a very, very strong reaction from the Somaliland Camel Corps. They were very bitter.
How did that show itself?
Well, as we were embarking, or just before we were embarking, the Somaliland Camel Corps were disbanded and they were paid. Well, they were given the money and they threw it on the ground. They were aggressive and belligerent in a way that they were doing a lot of shouting and talking and that, and nobody seemed to understand what they were saying. It was obviously not very complimentary. They were disgusted and they showed it. We couldn't interpret what they said, but they left no doubt in your mind exactly what they meant.
What were they disgusted with exactly?
The fact that we were running away. It's what they looked on.
Do you think that they feared what might happen to them under the Italians?
I don't think they were worried about that. They would have gone on fighting Italians anyway, because the whole of that area of Africa, the Somalis, the Abyssinians, and that, they're natural fighters. And it wouldn't have worried them to go on fighting the Italians, and they just wouldn't have given the Italians a chance to catch them and do much to them. But they were disgusted that they had been let down by us. The Somaliland Camel Corps had a very good reputation. And our pullout involved them. They were part of us, and they were let down.
Do you think they might have thought that the British were cowards?
Definitely, yeah.
I think that you said earlier that there were some hurricanes which were destroyed on the ground.
That's right. 3 hurricanes came over from Aden. You see, all the time we were in Somaliland, except for the 3 Blenheims that came in Hargeisa, we never saw any British aircraft. And apart from a gun sent up from the Australian cruiser Hobart, we never had any artillery. Hobart's gun was captured and destroyed, and his crew was killed in one of the attacks on the Tuggeranong. They were all lost. The Blenheims that came in Hargeisa at the beginning of the beginning of the action, they were all lost. None of them got back to Aden. But the Hurricanes came in, we were hoping that there'd be something to turn the tables. They landed in the evening outside Berbera, and the planes were lagered down, and the first light, the Italians came over, and they strafed the lot on the ground. Not one was left. So they never went into action.
When you got to Berbera, were you able to go straight on board the ships?
More or less, yes. It was natural with troops who had to be lined up and marshaled, and it was an orderly embarkation. There was no undue haste about it. It wasn't a panic, it wasn't a sort of a rush or anything like this. It was an orderly evacuation, and yes, I would say, circumstances considered, we went straight on board the ships.
About how many ships were there for the evacuation?
I don't know, but there must have been more than one, because I was on one that most of the Northern Rhodesia Regiment were on, and there were other units to come off. I mean, behind us was the Black Watch anyway, and they weren't on the one that we went on.
Was the ship, your ship, packed or not?
It wasn't packed, it was full. You know, it wasn't sort of standing room only, so nobody knew where to go. It was well full, but nothing more.
What kind of a ship was it?
Oh, I should say it was about somewhere between 5,000 and 7,000 ton ordinary tramp.
What was the morale of the Northern Rhodesia Regiment's troops?
I would have said it was good. The Africaners have got a very basic, down-to-earth attitude towards war and fighting things like this, and particularly if it's not his war, see, and he didn't consider this his war. Why she liked being a soldier and acquiring credit and that, and being a warrior and so on. I don't think he was unhappy to get out of a trap that he was in at Tuggeranong. There was no, neither with African nor European, was there any sense of a debacle or anything like that. There was never any doubt that we were winning the war, and we were going to win the war. even though at that time that was completely unjustified, but then we didn't know the major position, say, Western Desert and all the rest of it. As far as we were concerned there, we weren't happy at leaving, on one hand. On the other hand, we weren't unhappy that, right, we'll get them somewhere or another, somewhere later. There was no sort of despair or, you know, this is it, this is the end, all that kind of thing, nothing like that at all. And the African was the same. He thought he'd done a good job there. They'd all been in action. All the ones that came out were still alive, and they were very glad of that. And they're going to go back to the villages sooner or later, and they're going to say they're big warriors, that kind of thing, which is a big thing with the African. The warrior is looked up to.
Were you evacuated to Aden?
To Aden, yes.
What happened there?
Well, we had a very good reception going into Aden. There's a big battleship there. And as the ship went in, oddly enough, went in one of the sandstorms. It was very little visibility going in, but we were sort of played in from this battleship. And the Askari were very impressed by this, and we were cheered, and all the rest of the boats went through. Then we were disembarked, and Aden had been prepared for us, and you know, there were facilities, accommodation, food, everything was laid on.
Was there any re-equipment there?
Yes, there was a basic re-equipment, because a lot of people came out, and I was one of them, with their uniform in tatters, but apart from that, my uniform was lousy anyway. It was moving on me. It was moving faster than I was. It was crawling all over me. And it was just taken off and burnt. And I was given equipment of a British NCO, and that was issued from the Royal Artillery had a depot there, and they issued, the quartermaster issued me stuff there, and same to the other NCOs on the regiment who'd lost their stuff or who needed temporary re-kitting.
About how long would you have been in Aden?
I think, if I remember rightly, we were there about 3 weeks to a place called Singapore Lines. Out of Aden, outside the rock, on the way to where the RAF had their base.
Where did you go to afterwards?
Well, we went back from there to Kenya. We landed in Mombasa again. We went up country to Langata camp. Langata is just outside Nairobi. And there the battalion was completely and fully re-equipped. A lot of the arms and stuff that come back were taken in, and we were reissued with new arms, rifles, particularly Bren guns and that, and Lewis guns. We'd had Lewis guns, British Somaliland, because we hadn't got a full equipment of Bren guns. And Bren guns were the European issue, and they hadn't been designed for a hot country and for a sandy country, and they did tend to jam in action. And then we got a modified version, which was designed for Western Desert and those conditions.
What did the modification consist of?
I wouldn't know what it consisted of. It meant that it could be used more easily and more, they were more reliable in very hot and sandy conditions. You see, in the sand, you get a very fine dust, apart from the abrasive sand. That dust is also abrasive, because it's the same material as the sand. And no matter how well you clean it and oil it and things like this, that dust sort of pervades everything and gets in there, and it tends to block the movement of the mechanism. But the Western Desert had to have their stuff modified, experience out there, and we got the same brand as they did, and they were perfectly okay. Had no trouble with them.
I think it was here that you were commissioned.
That's right, yeah.
And did you not have some problem with your uniform here?
Yes. As an NCO in the African Colonial Forces, which is what the NRR was, the European NCOs were issued with the same kit as an officer, with the exception of the Sam Brown belt and the pips, stars, the shoulder. In Somaliland, of course, I lost everything like that. That was all gone, bedding roll and all gear and equipment. In Aden, as I said, we were given a new issue of British NCO equipment. When I was commissioned, I was entitled under the old rules to an allowance for officer's uniform. And this was turned down on the basis of the fact I'd been given that originally. The only thing I would have been entitled to claim for would have been a Sam Brown belt. When I pointed out that the lot had been lost in Somaliland and the stuff I walked in out in had to be burnt anyway, so I literally naked when I came out, they said, oh, well, you were reissued with another set. I said, well, that wasn't an officer's type of equipment I was issued with. It was BNCO. And they said, oh, well, you're issued with officer's type equipment originally, and therefore we can't give you any grant.
Did you get it eventually?
I did get it eventually, after I was back in Europe, and it took about 2 years to get it.
What happened next after the re-equipment at Nairobi?
We did a considerable amount of training. Amongst other things, the company I was with, D Company, was sent to the officer cadet school, and I think that was in Nakuru, and we were a demonstration company for the officer's cadet school. I was also sent, after having been commissioned, I was sent on an infantry officer's tactical course.
Was that useful?
Oh, yes, it was. It would have been more useful if I'd had it before going to Somaliland, but it was still useful. I didn't really use it subsequently because I wasn't in action again until I went into Western Europe. And since I was shot almost immediately, I didn't last all that long either. But it was a useful training, very useful training.
What type of things did you learn that you could have used in Somaliland?
Movement, fire, adjustment of fire and movement, covering fire, moving small bodies of troops forward, reconnaissance work.
What happened to you next?
Well, after the infantry training course and after the OCCHU, that we were prepared, we were sent off to Singapore. However, before that, we went into Malindi, which is on the coast. We were given, that's immediately after coming back from Aden, after being re-equipped at Langkawi, they then sent us down to Malindi, and we had about 3 weeks there. Malindi is a sea coast resort about 80 miles north of Nairobi, of Mombasa. A very beautiful place, all palm trees, white beaches and everything else. An ideal holiday resort. And we were down there and we were sort of really resting there. But that was the one place where we got another air raid, and I think it was one of the few they ever carried out on Kenya. And it came out... It came in an afternoon when we were being lectured by the battalion MO on shell and bomb wounds.
Did it cause any damage?
None at all. They were after an airstrip there and they dropped a couple of bombs on it, but they're so small they didn't really make any damage at all. You know, you shovel the dirt, through the dirt strip anyway. They just filled in the holes. It damaged our morale a bit because being lectured on, you know, stomach cavities and chest cavities and what shell splinters and bomb splinters do to you. In the middle of all this comes this air alarm. And we shot out straight into the slit trenches. But that's about all. We were surprised to be hit down there because we were so far away from anything vital. But we discovered later, after the end of the Abyssinian campaign, that the Italians were extremely well up on their intelligence and knew that we were there as a battalion at Malindi. And they knew that we'd been in Somaliland. And they just did that. There was only one plane. It was sort of bravado or something like that. They They couldn't have achieved any tactical objective but bombing Malindi. There's nothing there. I mean, if they dropped them on Nairobi, yes.
How do you think they were getting their intelligence?
Oh, we knew that. It was Africans. They were completely... they worked for both sides indiscriminately. After all, it was a white man's war. We were both white men. Along the border, the African tribes were passing back and forwards all the time. Same as the situation we had in Somaliland, the Targation.